Buddhist Summer School, Tuesday, 19th August, 1986. A reading of the Brahmayu Sutta, Majjhima number 91, might give us the impression that Gautama the Buddha, as far as social manners were concerned, was a prototype of the perfect English gentleman of the Victorian era. It is a modern fashion to decry some aspects of the Victorian code of behavior as sham virtue. But the Victorian code, when sincerely observed, was not hypocritical. It was decent. It had its own charm and Dickensian funniness. The Buddha's observance of the prevalent code in his day was meticulous and exemplary. His courtesy and considerateness towards anyone and everyone were beyond reproach. He never hesitated to point out the ill behavior of any thoughtless and discourteous visitor. For example, Pokkarasadi, a great Brahmin teacher in Ichchanakala, heard that Gautama, of whom an excellent report was spread abroad, together with about 500 monks, had arrived and was staying at the Ichchanakala wood. So Pokkarasadi called Ambattha, one of his well-versed pupils, and asked him to visit Gautama and find out whether the eulogistic report was true. Now, Ambattha suffered from pride of birth. Accompanied by a retinue, his Brahmin fellow pupils, he went and met Gautama. The Brahmins who accompanied him exchanged the greetings and compliments of politeness and courtesy with the Blessed One and took their seats. But Ambattha, walking about, said something or other of a civil kind in an offhand manner, fidgeting about the while, or standing up to the Blessed One sitting there, and calling the Shakyas, Gautama's clan, shavelings, sham friars, menial blackfellows. Gautama tells Ambattha he is rude, elicits from him the purpose of his visit, and gently suggests that he ask Gautama what he wanted to know. In the course of a long conversation, Gautama discloses that Ambattha's ancestress was a slave girl called Disa, by whom Okkaka, the king of the Sakyas, begat Kanha, who was Ambattha's male ancestor and who became a sage. Ambattha's pride is broken, and Gautama concludes that part of the conversation by saying, "The Kshatriya is the best of those who put their trust in lineage. But he who is perfect in wisdom and righteousness, he is the best among gods and men." Ambattha, now humble, asks Gautama, "But what is this righteousness, this conduct, this wisdom spoken of by Gautama. And Gautama patiently expounds the teaching in full detail, because the whole discourse is tremendously long, therefore. Ambattha retails it fully to his teacher, Pokkarasadi, and both of them betake themselves to Gautama, to the Dhamma, and to the order. In what manner do you imagine Gautama exposed and reprimanded Ambattha? Take another example of the way in which Gautama reprimanded a monk named Sudinla for indulging in sexual intercourse with his former wife. This comes in the first volume of the Vinaya Pitaka, the Sutta Vibhanga 3, 19 and 20. Sudinla happened to visit his parents because they were very, very depressed at his going away from home to homelessness. They were very wealthy people and were concerned about all their wealth and to whom it should be bequeathed. So they persuaded Sudinla to have marital congress with his former wife and beget a son who would then be the inheritor of all this wealth, and their way of life could be carried on. But Sudinla's failure to observe the strict rule of abstention from all sexual relations acceded to the request, and this became known to the other monks, who asked Gautama, "What about this?" And Gautama listens to it all and then says, "It is not fit, foolish man, not becoming, not proper. It is unworthy of a recluse, not lawful. It ought not to be done." The Buddha continues to address him as foolish man and goes on to say, "It were better for you, foolish man, that your male organ should enter the mouth of a terrible and poisonous snake, a black snake, than that it should enter a woman. And why should it be so? Because for that reason you would go to death, or to suffering like unto death, but not on that account would you pass after death to the waste, the bad born, the abyss, hell, but for this reason, namely sexual intercourse, you would do so." Note that the Buddha never addresses the sexual offender by such phrases as "you dirty dog," or "you filthy fornicator," or by any other foul language. He just says, "foolish man." The sound of his voice, as described by Uttara, who was a pupil of another Brahman teacher, Brahmayu, is distinct, intelligible, sweet, audible, fluent, clear, deep, and resonant. I could very much wish all speakers to be distinct, clear, and audible above all. I think the Buddha says all that he says quite gently and with perfect compassion, for he knows the consequent suffering that befalls the wrongdoer. The Buddha was incapable of self-righteousness or hate or violence in thought or speech or action. Speaking to the Brahmin Janusoni, who was chaplain to the king, about the discipline of the bhikkhu, which applied also to Gotama himself, he says, abandoning harsh speech, he is one who abstains from harsh speech. Whatever speech is gentle, pleasing to the ear, affectionate, going to the heart, urbane, that is, exhibiting elegance, refinement, and courtesy, pleasant and agreeable to the many folk, he comes to be one who utters speech like this. Now, I cannot imagine that a phrase like, it is better for your male member to enter the mouth of a terrible and poisonous black snake, or enter a fiery, burning charcoal pit, is pleasant to the ear or exactly urbane. But I'm sure Gotama said such things in a gentle, soothing, and persuasive voice. At the same time, suffusing the listener with a stream of metta and karuna from his great heart and his powerful mind. And the Buddha's metta and karuna were such that they could calm down an intoxicated, raging elephant. The sting in the Buddha's exposition of a monk's ill deed was the bitter medicine which effected the cure. His loving kindness and compassion healed the psyche, the tonic after the medicine. Thus, the erring monk would see very clearly the nature of his fault and also be psychically healed. Now, I'll read you this account of how he quells the intoxicated, raging elephant. Devadatta, as you know, was a schismatic. He secured King Ajatasattu's consent to the murder of the Buddha. And he hired 31 men to carry out his purpose. All these men, however, notwithstanding they were notorious criminals, were so affected by the majesty and loving kindness of the master that they could not raise hand against him, but on the contrary, experienced conversion and joined the community. Devadatta was now convinced that the Buddha could not be slain by any human being and determined to let loose upon him the fierce elephant Malagiri. This beast was accustomed to drink 8 measures of spirituous liquor every day. But Devadatta commanded the keeper to give it 16 measures the next day and to let it loose against the Buddha as he proceeded through the streets with his begging bowl. The Buddha was informed of what was to be done, but he refused to change his usual procedure. And he entered the city at the usual hour, accompanied by a company of bhikkhus. Soon afterwards, the elephant was let loose upon him, and at once it raged through the streets, working havoc. The bhikkhus entreated the master to escape, but as he would not, they sought to walk before him in order that he might not be the first to meet the savage beast, But this the Buddha forbade, albeit in the case of Ananda, his doing so was only prevented by the exercise of miraculous power. At this moment, the elephant was about to destroy the mother of a child who had run into the street in ignorance of the danger. But the Buddha called to the elephant, "It was not intended that you should destroy any other being than myself. Here am I. Waste not your strength on any less noble object." On hearing the voice of Buddha, the elephant looked towards him, and immediately the effects of the liquor passed away, and the elephant approached him in the gentlest fashion and kneeled before him. What an elephant! The master charged him to take no life in future, but to be kind to all people. And the elephant repeated the 5 precepts before the assembled crowds. No one can complain that the Hindus did not have a wonderful imagination. Thus, the rage of Malagiri was subdued, and had he not been a quadruped, he might have entered the first path. As Buddha had thus performed a miracle, he reflected that it would not be becoming to seek alms in the same place, and he therefore returned to the Jetavana monastery without proceeding on his usual course. There is a deep lesson for mankind in the Buddha's method. Fear or cruelty or the infliction of painful punishment or the imposition of sanctions are not productive of virtue or peace or well-being or right-doing or happiness. These can be realized only through clear perception, understanding, patience, forbearance, wisdom, and compassion. If a wrongdoer's conscience is stirred in the right way, that is the proper point of departure from wrongdoing for him. A Buddha, a Christ, a perfected Holy One has the ability to see exactly what a man's psyche is like. Gautama himself declared that this was one of his vijjas. You will find it in Majjhima 126, 170, 183, etc. and in the Digha Nikaya, volume 2, 79f. Gautama clearly perceived and fully understood not only the imperfect psyche and its defilements, but also the perfectly purified psyche through which pure mind could function. It is this which he examined, the utterly purified psyche, when he stood for 7 days staring at the root of the Bodhi tree after his enlightenment. The root of this tree is the brain. Sri Krishna starts the 15th discourse of the Gita with these words: "With roots above, branches below, the Ashwatha tree is said to be indestructible. The leaves of it are hymns. He who knoweth it is a Veda knower. This tree is the tree of life. Its human bodily correspondent is the brain, the spinal cord, and the nervous system, the material apparatus through which the psyche works. When the psyche is utterly purified, void of all ill, it is transparent, and then pure mind functions freely through it. Brain cells themselves undergo a change, a transmutation, so that the brain becomes capable of inspired concept and word to clothe whatever pure mind conveys to it. This tree of life, which is referred to also in Genesis, and the tree of good and evil, the knowledge of good and evil, is just this tree. The brain, the spinal cord, and the nervous system. That is the tree. And if you eat of the fruit of the tree of life, what happens is that discriminative consciousness springs into existence then, and you start separating this from that, choosing this which is pleasant to oneself, and discarding or trying to destroy that which is unpleasant for oneself. Has it ever struck theologians that both trees are supposed to be right in the middle of the garden? Now, how on earth can you have a material tree in the middle of the garden? I mean, two material trees right in the middle of the garden. But this is what it means, really. If you study the Kabbalah carefully, you may find some information there. This utterly purified psyche was realized by Gautama. Apparently, it was a unique realization in his day. None of his teachers, Alara Kalama or Uddaka Ramaputta, could tell him anything about it. So he spent 7 days and nights examining this perfected psyche. Therefore, knowing the nature of the imperfect psyche, impure because of the defilements inherited through hundreds of millions of years of organic evolution, and also knowing through his enlightenment the utterly purified psyche, he could quite legitimately say to Upaka on the high road between Gaya and the Bodhi tree, "Victorious over all, omniscient am I, among all things undefiled, leaving all through death of craving freed. By knowing for myself, whom should I point to as my teacher? For me, there is no teacher. One like me does not exist. In the world with its devas, no one equals me." Now, reading this in modern times, in our civilization, one would say, what an extraordinarily conceited person that must have been to speak like that. But he was just telling the truth. "For I am perfected in the world, a teacher supreme am I. I alone am all awakened." Note, all awakened, the emphasis is on the all. "Become cool am I, Nibbana attained. To turn the Dhamma wheel, I go to Kasi's city, beating the drum of deathlessness in a world that's blind become." Upaka says, "According to what you claim, your reverence, you ought to be the victor of the unending." The Buddha replies, "Like me, they are victors indeed who have won destruction of the cankers, vanquished by me are evil things. Therefore am I, Upaka, a victor. This victor, this vanquisher of all evil things, this destroyer of the cankers, this perfected Holy One, this all-awakened, Nibbana-attained, Supreme Teacher, Sammāsambuddha, was the one who observed the code of perfect manners prevalent in his day. If you study the Brahmāya Sutta, you will find the detailed exposition by the Brahman youth Uttara of his answers, of his manners, his deportment, and his graciousness. The observance of perfect manners indicates your own refinement, your considerateness for those in whose company you are, your respect for each person as a person. A dear relative of mine who, through years of travel, knew European and American people fairly well and was a good judge of character, said to me years ago that an outstanding good quality of English people was their genuine respect for personality. This was before World War II. I wonder what he would perceive and say if he were alive now. If the Buddha did not respect each person, whoever he was and however he behaved, for example, Ambattha and Satchakka, a son of Jain people, could he have dealt with him with patience and forbearance, with a deep considerateness born of mercy and love's lordliness, which he extended to every individual? In his childhood, Siddhartha Gautama had great Brahman sages like Vishwamitra to teach him. It is not unlikely that the meaning of the word Purusha, in Pali it is Purusa, a person as presented in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, was known to him. The Upanishad states, in the beginning, this world was only the Atma in the form of a person, Purusha Veda. Looking round and seeing nothing other than himself, he said first, I am. Thus arose the name I. Because prior, and the Sanskrit is Purva, prior to all this world, he, that is the Atma in the form of a person, burned up. The Sanskrit root is ush, all evils, therefore he is called Purusha, a person. That's a wonderful conception of the word person. I know that philologists, trained philologists, would not agree with this sort of thing at all, but the Upanishads were not concerned with philology. They were concerned with suggesting the truth in the best way they could in their time. We can see, therefore, that the old Upanishadic teachers, centuries before the days of the Buddha, equated person with the perfected Holy One, he who had burnt out all evils, obviously. The last chapter of the Dhammapada equates Brahman with the perfected Holy One. You know how in the last chapter the Buddha says, him I call a Brahman who, and he goes right through the whole gamut of the virtues. And the Buddha said of himself, "Monks, I am a Brahman." I quoted this the other day. It comes from the Itivuttaka, chapter 4, verse 1. The Buddha's whole teaching is calculated to enable each person to bring the divine potential inherent in him to fruition. Naturally then, the manners of the perfect man could be no other than perfect manners. I mentioned earlier the name of Uttara, a Brahman youth. He was an advanced, promisingly bright pupil of the Brahman whose name was Brahmayu, who was now a worn-out old man, 120 years of age. He was master of the three Vedas, the Rig, the Yajur, and the Saman, versed in the vocabularies and rituals, together with the phonology and exegesis and the legendary tradition. He was learned in idioms, a grammarian, proficient in popular philosophy, and had the 32 marks of the great man on his body. He lived in a place called Mithila. Now it happened that the Buddha, together with 500 monks, was walking on tour in Videha, one of the northeastern kingdoms. Brahmayu heard about this and about the most lovely report gone abroad concerning the revered Gotama, namely, that he is indeed Lord, perfected one, fully self-awakened one, endowed with knowledge and right conduct, welfarer, knower of the worlds, the matchless charioteer of men to be tamed, teacher of devas and mankind, the awakened one, the Lord. Having realized through his own super knowledge, he makes known this world together with devas, including the Maras and the Brahmas, creatures together with recluses and Brahmans, with devas and mankind. He teaches Dhamma that is lovely at the beginning, lovely in the middle, lovely at the end. He explains with the spirit and the letter the Brahma fairing completely fulfilled and wholly purified. Good indeed is the sight of perfected ones such as these. That was the kind of report circulated about Gotama. The Venerable Brahmayu sent Uttara to meet Gotama and to find out whether this report was true or not. Uttara saw the 32 marks of the great man, Mahapurusha. Of course, the term great man meant perfected holy one, on Gotama's body, and resolved to follow him closely and watch his conduct. Like a constant shadow, Uttara followed the Lord closely for 7 months. After that, Uttara returned to Mithila and gave a full account of his observations, confirming the lovely report noised abroad about Gotama. In due time, the Lord, walking on tour, arrived in Mithila and stayed in Makadeva's mango grove. Then Brahmayu, after having received Gotama's permission to visit him, note carefully, the old man of 120 years asks the permission of the much younger man, almost 2 generations younger, before he visits him. So Brahmayu goes and visits Gautama. They are followed with deep respect and courtesy some questions which were answered by the Lord, culminating with a full exposition by the Buddha of the Four Noble Truths. Brahmayu asks the Buddha to accept him as his lifelong follower and invites him and the 500 monks to lunch next day. I'm using the word lunch, but the usual form is the next day's meal. And a very good practice, just have one meal in the middle of the day. Might not do in cold climates. Not just for the following day, but for 7 days did Brahmayu serve and satisfy the monks with the awakened one at their head. Then the Lord continued his tour in Videha. Not long afterwards, Brahmayu died. What a regal banquet! What a heavenly passing away! Let us conclude with the mendicant Sabbiya's panegyric on the Buddha. Comes on pages 82 and 3 of the Sutta Nipata. Sabbiya has been to the Buddha and has been taught. And Sabbiya says, O quickening sage, who didst dispel the heresies of mendicants' disputes, those 63 points, fragments of inference and term. I don't quite understand what that means, fragments of term, T-E-R-M. And dark flood crossed. Thou to ill's end art gone. Yon fairer, man of worth, thou art, the all-awake. I deem thee cankerless. Vision and light are thine, thine wisdom wide. Thou hast ill-ender, O ill-ender, helped me to cross, grasped my perplexity, and borne me over my doubt. To thee be worship given. Kin of the sun, goal one, sage of the silent ways, vital, compassionate, my former doubts, O seer, thou hast explained. In sooth, thou art a sage awake. For thee, no obstacle remains. For thee, all moil is stilled and blotted out. And thou art cool and tamed, persistent, active, truth. O sinless energy, at thy words Narada and Parvata rejoiced, and all the Deva hosts. O thoroughbred of men, O noblest of all mankind, peerless in all the worlds, to thee be worship given. Thou art the wake, thou art the teacher, thou the sage o'er Mara triumphing, hast cut all leanings off, and crossed thyself, dost help mortality to cross. By thee are cankers crushed, affections overcome. Affections in the sense of attachments, not in the sense of metta or karuna. And banished fear and dread, thou lion unattached, as water soileth not the lovely lotus bloom, even so thou art unsoiled by merit or ill deeds. Hero, stretch forth thy feet. Sabir salutes the Lord. You know the mode of salutation. The disciple kneels right down and lays his head on the teacher's feet. That is the panegyric of Sabir. It's very interesting. I think we have good time. There is one other thing which I would like to read to you. This is one of the legends which is the pathetic story of Kunala, the son of Ashoka. Ashoka the emperor, whose eyes are put out by his wicked stepmother without awakening in his heart any feelings of anger or hatred. Oldenburg has given the legend in full in his book, but this is a summary of the thing. Kunala, this name was given to him on account of his wonderfully beautiful eyes, which are as beautiful as the eyes of the bird. Kunala lives far from the bustle of the court, devoted to meditation on impermanence. One of the queens is burning with love for the beautiful youth, but her solicitation and the menaces of disdained beauty are alike in vain. Thirsting for revenge, she contrives to have him sent to a distant province and then issues an order to that quarter, sealed with the slyly stolen ivory seal of the king, for the prince's eyes to be torn out. When the order arrives, no one can be prevailed upon to lay hands on the noble eyes of the prince. The prince himself offers rewards to anyone who should be prepared to execute the king's order. At last, a man appears, repulsive to look on, who undertakes the performance. When, amid the cries of the weeping multitude, the first eye is torn out, Kunala takes it in his hand and says, "Why seest thou no longer those forms on which thou wast just now looking, thou coarse ball of flesh? How they deceive themselves, how blamable are those fools who cling to thee and say, 'This is I.'" And when his second eye is torn out, he says, "The eye of flesh, which is hard to get, has been torn from me, but I have won the perfect, faultless eye of wisdom. The king has forsaken me, but I am the son of the highly exalted king of truth, whose child I am called." He is informed that it is the queen by whom the command concerning him was issued. Then he says, "Long may she enjoy happiness, life and power, who has brought me so much welfare." And he goes forth a beggar with his wife. And when he comes to his father's city, he sings to the lute before the palace. The king hears Kunala's voice. He has him called into him, but when he sees the blind man before him, he cannot recognize his own son. At last, the truth comes to light. The king, in the excess of rage and grief, is about to torture and kill the guilty queen. But Kunala says, "It would not become thee to kill her. Do as honor demands, and do not kill a woman. There is no higher reward than that for benevolence. Patience, sire, has been commanded by the Perfect One." And he falls at the king's feet, saying, "O king, I feel no pain, notwithstanding the inhumanity which has been practiced on me. I do not feel the fire of anger. My heart has none but a kindly feeling for my mother, who has given the order to have my eyes torn out. As sure as these words are true, may my eyes again become as they were." And his eyes shone in their old splendor as before.